Please turn now to John chapter 1. I am not going to read the whole text yet again, only the first verse, and then begin with verse 14. Our text for today's sermon is based on 14 and 15, and next week we will finish up the prologue. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. And we have seen His glory, glory as of the only Son from the Father, full of grace and truth. John bore witness about him and cried out, "This was he of whom I said, 'He who comes after me ranks before me, because he was before me.' And from his fullness we all have received grace upon grace. For the law was given by Moses, grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. No one has ever seen God. The only God who is at the Father's side, He has made Him known." The world is full of wonder at the sheer variety and at times seeming contradiction, both in macrocosm and microcosm, and great things and small, very small things, so small that your naked eye cannot see them. It never ceases to confound us. You put a drop of water under a microscope and you see it teeming with life and you wonder, how can all of this come together? How can all of this be made to work together? And this is just a drop of water. We don't need to fantasize about aliens invading our world to gain a sense of wonder and mystery. The world in which we live is full of it, and it has more than enough, more than we can handle, more than we can figure out. And of course, we expect there to be mystery and enigma, wonderful things as we study the world that God has made, because we know that He Himself is the mystery of all mysteries. How can we know Him, who cannot be compared with anything or to anyone that we know or experience? Indeed, whose otherness is such that He sternly warns against likening Him to any creature. But since we are talking about surprises, here's one for you. God made us in His likeness and in His own image. Oh yes, we are part of this creation. We were made from dust. But of all the creatures, only we are like God. I don't want to get tangled up in thorny theological issues. Not here, not now. And I will simply say this. God made the world and placed us in its midst so that by our very existence, just by being here and being what we are, we might indicate God's presence. Being God's image, and that is what we still are, being God's image means that we exist as living statues, images of God who made all things, thus pointing to Him. The strongest argument for God's existence may not be cosmological. The strongest argument for God's existence may not be teleological or whatever you want it to be. The strongest argument for God's existence stands right in front of you and sits next to you. Now tell me, indulge me. Tell me whether this isn't a most astounding idea. You image God. You are like God. And the emphasis isn't on appearance. This much is clear, because we are clearly not the greatest of creatures, not the strongest, not the swiftest. The emphasis is on character. You are like God in that you mediate His character, His way, and therefore His rule to the rest of creation. But if humans are the greatest wonder in this created cosmos, in this creation, nothing can touch the thought that our text now broaches. The point to which John has been driving all along. The Word became flesh and dwelt among us. Now, note, John has not named the Logos, the Word, since verse 1. And I read this together with our text to establish the connection, because here, to resume this language, to refer to the Logos, the Word, means that he wants you to look back and then to import the idea of verse 1 or verses 1 through 5 into our text. So, the Word who was in the beginning, who was with God, and the Word who is Himself God, no less than God, the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. John's prologue is saturated with allusions to the creation narrative, in particular days 1 and day 4 of Genesis 1. And in this context, and against that background, the allusions to the creation narrative, the Word becoming flesh, it can only mean one thing. All of creation, since the very first day, since the beginning, has been waiting for this. Somehow, God's purpose for the entire cosmos has now reached its climax, its telos. That goal wasn't reached when God made Adam on the sixth day of creation, which is the pinnacle of the creation narrative, the sixth day, when God made man in His own image. God's goal wasn't reached, not then. Do I say too much when I frame it this way? The world was made and exists so that the Word could dwell in it. This is the wonder of all wonders. Yeah, I know that we are Christians and we hear about the birth of Jesus every year about the same time. And you can get used to it, and because familiarity often breeds contempt, we stand in danger of missing the wonder of all wonders. But this is it. Look no further, look nowhere else. This is the wonder of all wonders. The Word becomes flesh and dwells among us. The Word. And remember that He's called the Word. Jesus is the Word. Jesus is called the Word because He exists forever and ever and ever. He has always existed as the self-expression of the Father. That's why He is the Son who proceeds from the Father eternally. He expresses the Father. He expresses His being. The Word became part of creation. Why? Why would He do this? Because we have failed. We have become corrupt and sinful. and we project an image of God, we are still the image. We can't change that. We are made this way and it will not change. We project an image, however, that is now twisted and perverse and dark. And not only this, but we do not even know God anymore, as we ought to. How then shall we image God properly? How could we? We don't even know God. This is why God sent the perfect image. The perfect image of himself in, as verse 14 puts it, the only Son from the Father. And Adam, who was made on the sixth day of creation, Adam was only a type of the Logos, the Father's true image, who came in the fullness of time, in the last days. He bears all of the attributes of the Father. And he is exactly like him because he is also God. He became flesh to do what we failed to do and continue to fail to do, to image God and to make known the Father to all creation. So he dwelt among us. Now, the word rendered dwelt is peculiar. And you cannot pass over it. You cannot leave it alone. It cries out for attention. It's peculiar. It means to dwell in a tent. A tent. This is a word that is used only here and in two other places in the New Testament, in the book of Revelation, presumably by the same author, the same apostle, the same John, who also wrote these words. The word became flesh and dwelt among us as in a tent. We could translate this very, very unique saying. And this sentence is sure to catch the attention of any reader who knows the Old Testament. It's a reference to the tabernacle. Without a doubt, it's a reference to the tent that housed God's presence during Israel's Exodus. And as we said during Sunday school this morning, this isn't something cumbersome. This isn't something awkward, God dwelling in a tent. This is to be seen for what it was. For the first time in the history of redemption, and for the first time in the history of the world since Eden, God localized his presence in a tangible way. He gave the people something to look at and to study and to learn from every day, by placing this tent in the midst of the camp of Israel. Well, this was a big deal. This was a great and wonderful thing. However, it wasn't the final thing, not the real thing that God had always envisioned. Because with this allusion to the tent, he dwelt among us as in a tent, John makes Jesus the true tent, the true temple of God, the dwelling place of God. And this is indeed what he has in mind. It's not only because this word is so strange, so peculiar, but when you read the Gospel of John, in the first public appearance of Jesus, other than the wedding at Cana, Jesus goes to the temple. This is how John begins his gospel, the ministry of Jesus. He goes to the temple, the dwelling place of God, and he cleanses it of all of the rubble and the corruption that is in there. And this is a violent display of holy anger. And the people, you couldn't even blame them for it. They said, "Who the heck do you think you are? You come here, you do these things. By what authority are you doing them?" And Jesus answers the people. He says, "You destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up." And John provides a theological, much needed commentary on what Jesus said there. He was speaking of the temple of his body. God became flesh so that he could dwell among us as the true temple of God. One of the things that we often have trouble with is when we think of the temple or the sanctuary of God, we think that it must look a certain way. What makes a temple is what looks like a temple, right? But this is not true with a true temple of God. Hence, it took everyone by surprise. What makes God's temple is not necessarily because it looks like a temple. What makes God's temple is God indwelling it. And God dwells in the Son. He is the true temple, none like him. He's the true tent, the true temple, the true dwelling place of God. And with this, there come three additional ideas that derive from this image of the tent. Jesus is God's true tent, the true dwelling place of God among people. And because he is, Jesus is the locus of God's revelation. Now, let me put it this way. Jesus is the true tent, the true dwelling place of God, and therefore he is also the place of God's revelation. And he is not only the place of God's revelation, he is also the proper place for sacrifice. And because he is all this, only Jesus is the place of meeting, where we meet with God. Now, there was a place that was called this way, the tent of meeting in the Old Testament. But the true tent, that's Jesus. In him, we meet God and we enjoy him forever. It's true. He may not look like a temple, but you must free yourself from this idea that a temple has to look like a temple in order for it to be the true temple. The true temple of God should take you by surprise because God is the mystery of all mysteries. He doesn't do things the way that we expect him to, and he always has a surprise up his sleeve, doesn't he? Well, now, God dwelling with his people, that's the cardinal little children. If you want to know what are God's promises, how could you put this in one word, in one sentence? You could say God dwells with his people. That's the cardinal idea of all of God's covenantal promises from beginning to end. I will dwell with you. I will be with you. I will be your God. That's the cardinal core idea of all of God's covenantal promises in Scripture. And let me cite a few for you by way of reminder. One of them was read to you earlier this morning by Richard Crossman. Exodus 25, verse 8. Let them make me a sanctuary that I may dwell in their midst. Exodus chapter 29, verse 25, still read by the same Richard Crossman. I will dwell among the people of Israel, and I will be their God. Leviticus 26, verse 11. I will make my dwelling with you, and I will walk among you, and I will be your God. And when the Old Testament prophets, we could cite more examples, but when the Old Testament prophets spoke of the new covenant which they anticipated and the messianic age, they used this image of God dwelling in the midst of his people, like a tent. Ezekiel 37, verse 26, for example, says, I will make a covenant of peace with them, and I will place my sanctuary in their midst. My dwelling place shall be with them, and I will be their God. Zechariah 2:10, sing and rejoice, O daughter of Zion, for behold, I am coming, and I will dwell in your midst. And in that day, many nations will join themselves to Yahweh, for I will dwell in your midst. And so this concept of God dwelling with his people is the core and is the substance of God's promises to his people. And this idiom continues into the New Testament. Well, it's no wonder that it does. Right off the bat, when you open your book to the New Testament, you come to the Gospel of Matthew, and Matthew reflects upon the birth of Jesus Christ, and he recalls the prophecy of Isaiah chapter 7, verse 14, words that you all have heard before. Behold, a virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and you shall call his name Emmanuel, which means God with us. Jesus is the true tent in which God dwells with us. The Apostle Paul cites Leviticus chapter 26, verse 11, one of the chief texts that talk about this Emmanuel principle, that God dwells with his people, has a sanctuary among his people. He says, and he describes our relationship, our fellowship with God in Jesus Christ, who is the true temple, and we therefore also are the temple of God in him. I will make my dwelling among them and walk among them, and I will be their God. So, when Jesus became one of us, when the Word became flesh, and this is what John says in using this peculiar word with its rich biblical associations, to dwell as in a tent, when the Word became flesh, God's promise of being and dwelling with his people was fulfilled as he intended it. The visible, physical body of Jesus Christ is the true temple of God. Never mind as to what you think a temple should look like. He is the true temple. And never before had God been dwelling among us as closely and as truly as in this tent, in this person, the Son. To me, it's an amazing thought that our human nature is even capable of and has indeed received into itself the fullness of deity, as also Colossians 2:9 affirms. Paul says, in him the fullness of deity dwells bodily. It did then, it still does today. Nonetheless, the meaning of John's words is clear. It is clear. Just as the Old Testament tent housed God's presence in a preliminary and yet also in a real way, so Jesus is now the true and permanent temple or tent or dwelling place of God among us. And from this, then, derive three additional truths that are also embedded and woven into this text. And I will remain true to the image of the tent, because this really ties it all together and it makes it clear. The Old Testament tent, it was not only the place where God dwelt among the people, but it was also the place of revelation. Again, you may not have thought about the tent or the temple of the Old Testament as a place of revelation, but that really is what it is. Why would God place a tent in the midst of his people dwell there if it didn't also say something to the people? Everything about the architecture, the materials, the furniture within that tent that they made at Mount Sinai, it said something about the God who dwelt in it. Every sacrifice that the priests then offered within the courts of that tent, it had something to say about God's plan of redemption, all of them. Every day, every time. And of course, in that tent, there was hovering over the Ark of the Covenant in the most holy place. The Ark of the Covenant, which is referred to itself as the testimony. It said something. There was hovering over this Ark of the Covenant the visible presence of God, the cloud of glory. The Hebrews called it the Shekhinah. And the Israelites, they beheld that cloud when God first took up residence in the tent. The cloud filled that tent so that no one could enter. It wasn't safe. And they also beheld that cloud. They beheld the presence of God in a visible manifestation at the dedication of Solomon's temple. And God first took up residence of that structure or in that structure. John has this in mind. You see, the temple or the tent as the place of revelation when he says, we beheld his glory. Glorious of the only Son from the Father. The glory of God in Christ's person is perfect. It's perfect because he is the only Son from the Father. He exists, he forever exists as the self-expression of the Father, as the Logos. He is the true image of God, perfectly picturing God, perfectly expressing God. That's what he is by his very nature. It means that he is exactly like him. All the Father's attributes are also on display in his Son, the only Son. And as the writer to the Hebrews says, the Son is the radiance of God's very glory, and he is the exact imprint of his character. The glory that John therefore saw in Jesus when he walked the earth and dwelt among us, as he says, it wasn't a dazzling, menacing light or a devouring fire that people got scared of. The glory that he saw was in the character of this person. And the character of that person, the Word, Jesus Christ, revealed the full breadth of what the Father is like. It was the fullness of the Father's character, now seen in his only Son, such as it had never been seen before. Yes, there were glimpses here when Moses or Joshua or the prophets did or said things, when God worked through them. But never was there the Word dwelling among us. Because it's only the Son who, as he says, is at the Father's side, who has made him known. Only the Son can. Only he can make him known. And you, therefore, you ought never to say, oh, well, you know, Jesus, God, all this business, he's so aloof. He's so irrelevant. He's not real for me, and he doesn't know how I feel. He doesn't know what I go through. Is he even here? Does he even consider it? You ought never to say this. In Jesus Christ, he is as real to you as anyone whom you can see and touch. And he can sympathize with you because he lived in this world. He knows what it's like to be here. And he knows you. Not as a judge, ready to condemn you, consign you, and give you what you deserve. He knows you as your best friend who will never let you down, who will never think evil of you, who will never keep some sort of bitterness toward you. He knows you as his son and daughter, and you know God through him. Jesus is the locus. Jesus is the place of God's revelation. Therefore, because he is the place of revelation, you must expose yourself to this sight, to his presence, as much as you can, because only then is Jesus also your strength, and he will become your strength in increasing fashion or measure. Some years ago, there was an advertisement by an oil company, and there is a man driving in a car through the desert, and he runs out of gas. So he steps out of his car, opens the trunk, and pulls out a canister, and then walks and walks. And as he continues to walk through the desert under the sun, beating on his head, he becomes more and more exhausted. He is near death. He's perishing. And there in the horizon, there's the logo of a gas station. But he walks past it. He doesn't stop. He keeps on walking and walking, and he keeps on walking until finally there is another logo of a gas station looming in the distance. That's the right logo. That's the right oil company. And as he fills his canister, his eyes lighten up, and he looks like a newborn baby. Well, advertisement always manages to mimic what Jesus or what God is to us. Jesus is your strength, and it's worthwhile passing by all those other sources of strength and life. It's worthwhile waiting. It's worthwhile seeking. It's worthwhile keeping going, or to keep going, because he is the source of your strength. But John isn't content with saying that Jesus is God's sanctuary and that therefore he is also the locus of God's revelation, as was the Old Testament tent. He singles out two specific attributes that, as he claims, have revealed God's glory to the fullest extent. We beheld his glory, he says, glorious of the only Son from the Father, full of grace and truth. Grace and truth. I could give you a dictionary definition and miss the point. And if I gave you a theological definition, I would still not be able to communicate what John is saying. Now, one thing is certain, grace and truth are principles. You can't take this away. But grace and truth are no mere principles that you can define and so fill with meaning. Grace and truth describe a person. Jesus is the fullness of God's graciousness and truthfulness. That's the gist of this language, grace and truth. And by the way, this word pair, grace and truth, John lifts this from the Old Testament, where a Hebrew word pair performs the same function. It's usually translated steadfast love and faithfulness, and that is a very good way of also thinking of grace and truth. But however this is, his graciousness, what is this? His graciousness is his disposition toward you. That's his heart toward you. He chooses to love you. He chooses to be gracious, and then he goes to work. The Old Testament word hidden behind gracious or grace is chesed. It's a covenantal term. It combines the idea of firmness and love, steadfast love. God binds himself to you, never to turn away from you in doing what is best. He commits himself to this, and he cannot walk away from it, no more than he can walk away from his creation. He has to do what he says, what he has promised to do. And God applies his graciousness, his steadfast love by faithfully fulfilling his promises. That is, he never fails to be true to his word. Hence, grace and truth. There is no power that can sever these two, this pair. And nothing will thwart the end toward which this pair is pressing relentlessly. So let me ask you, what is the fullness of grace and truth, of steadfast love and faithfulness? What's the end of these? Well, God's graciousness and truthfulness, that he is true to his promises, that he will fulfill them, that's seen throughout Scripture. It's seen in the Old Testament, and it's seen in the New Testament. And grace and truth were also seen in the incarnation of Jesus Christ. Why would God do this? Is it not because he is faithful? He said that he would dwell with his people. Well, here now, he dwells with you. Grace and truth were seen in the words that he spoke, and they were seen in the deeds that he did. Every gesture of his, if we can imagine this, was full of grace and truth. He is the Word. He is the self-expression of the Father. Doesn't get any better than this. He is he. However, all this was just the prelude to the grand finale. Graciousness and truthfulness were not revealed in fullness until John saw what happened on the day Jesus was crucified. You won't know it until you see and believe it. That in the tent or the sanctuary of his own body, Jesus offered the ultimate sacrifice. Jesus paid the price for your breaking the covenant. His gracious disposition toward you and his being true to his word crystallize in his giving himself up for you. It's this. Ultimately, it's this that John has in mind, and I can assure you of this. When he speaks of glory, you must think of the words that Jesus prayed on the eve of his suffering when he said, "Father, give glory to the Son, that the Son may give glory to you." He knew that the ultimate glorification of God is in the cross. And when he speaks of the fullness of grace and truth, no less. And in light of it, every sin of mine is so much more horrendous. Every sin of mine is so much more pernicious. And every form of bitterness and hatred that I continue to harbor against other people or even against God's own people, the same. You cannot excuse it, not in light of this fullness of grace and truth, graciousness and truthfulness toward you. Now, what I say is this. The Old Testament tent was the place of sacrifice, and God was very jealous about this. You couldn't bring your sacrifices anywhere you wanted to and slaughter them. You could not do it any which way you wanted to. You had to do it the proper way, and that means only in one place at God's appointed sanctuary. That's where you bring your sacrifice. And God was jealous about this because all of this pointed to the only temple in which the only sacrifice that God would ever accept to atone for sin would be received. It's the temple of Jesus, Jesus' own body. And there is no greater steadfast love. There's no greater grace. And there is no fuller expression of faithful commitment to us than seen in him hanging on the cross. He knows that my sins make it impossible for him to forgive me and to justify me. He knows that your sins make it impossible for him to justify you. What does he do? How can he be faithful and truthful to his promise that he would be your God and that he would dwell with you forever? He pays your bill. He takes your place. And he offers up himself as a sacrifice for sin in the temple of his own body that was made for this purpose. He was indeed full of graciousness and truthfulness, steadfast love and faithfulness. God's glory. God's glory. And it's before these two words, fully seen and fully accomplished in Jesus Christ, it is before these two words that I bow. And I most gladly humble myself before his grace and truth that save me. Grace and truth that save you. Don't you love him for this? Don't you love him for this? And finally, because of all these things, because he is the true temple and therefore the locus of revelation and of sacrifice, Jesus is also the meeting place between God and us. The Old Testament tent was called the tent of meeting, of which God said, "There I will meet with you, Moses, and there I will meet with the children of Israel." But Jesus is the one true tent of meeting. In him we meet, and we already have spiritual fellowship with God our Father. And we draw near. Yes, in him we draw near with confidence and with boldness to his throne of grace, knowing that the true and only Son from the Father, the true image, the exact imprint of his character, he has made us fit for it. And he will see to it that all will be fulfilled. He will make sure that we will enjoy him. I go to prepare a place for you. That's what he said before he went. And I will come again, and I will take you to myself, that where I am, you may be also. At the beginning, I told you that there are two other places where the same John also uses this peculiar word, to dwell in a tent. They're both in the book of Revelation, and both of them speak of the same reality. They speak of the consummation, when God will dwell with us in the way it was always intended to be. Revelation 7:15 says, "And they will be before God's throne forever, and God will tabernacle, dwell as in a tent, with them." And a fuller account is then given at the very end of the Bible in Revelation chapter 21, verse 3. Where we read, "Behold, the dwelling place of God is with man. He will tabernacle with them, and they will be his people, and he will be their God." God himself will be with them as their God. And what does that mean? He will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and death shall be no more. Neither shall there be mourning, nor crying, nor pain anymore, for the former things have passed away. There will be a day when God's dwelling with you will be perfect beyond imagination. But that's because the Word became flesh and dwelled among us as the true tent, the locus of revelation, of sacrifice, the meeting place. And in him, You have everything you need. And you are perfect in Him. And don't let anyone take this away from you. Don't let the circumstances of your life impinge upon this reality. Don't let anyone or anything take this from you. And don't lose heart in crisis. Don't lose heart in difficulty and in the hardship of your life. For you must not be hopeless. God became flesh and even now dwells with you. And that's how it always will be. But it will become better yet. Happy Christmas. Let's pray.